The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey, friends, and welcome to Afternoons with Mike right here on The Shepherd. I have on the line with me today Harrison Floyd. Harrison has been very involved both in business and in politics. He grew up traveling in the world with the United States Marine Corps. After 10 years of service, he studied at George Washington University, and he was the former executive director of the Black Voices for Trump. So, my man, you've been around. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And I understand that you know our Brittany from working with her in previous times.
Yes, Brittany represented the great state of Florida on the last national campaign. She did an outstanding job. She was definitely one of my favorite people to work with. She's truly awesome.
Well, she is, and we're grateful to have her here at The Shepherd, and she has opened the door for many great folks to be on my program, such as yourself. Tell me a little bit about you. Where did you grow up, and how did you come to know the Lord?
Yeah, so I grew up as an Army brat, traveling around the world, lived in Germany and some other places, moved every two or three years, and you know, growing up in a military family, my father's from the South and my mother's from New England. Religion has just always been something that has played a vital role, really giving us a very strong foundation growing up. And when you travel around the world so much, you know, you don't have anything that's constant in your life. And our faith in the Lord and, you know, being able to go to church, no matter where we were in the world, was something that kept us grounded all the time in faith. So that would be really where it drew from, I think.
Oh, that's wonderful, Harrison. Now, you know, many Army brats or military brats, such as yourself, growing up in a military home, they really don't want to continue that in their own life, but you did. What was the reason? You must have really loved this background that your dad modeled in front of you, and then you are enlisting yourself into the Marine Corps.
Yeah, so everyone in my family has served, aunts, uncles, both grandparents, both of my parents, actually, my younger brother. So for me growing up, it wasn't really so much of what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be when you grow up? It's more what branch are you going to serve in?
Okay. So it was already assumed.
Yes, it was a destiny.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So where did you serve in your time in the Marines?
So my primary MOS, I was a machine gunner. So I was in the infantry, but there was also other things that I did as well. I served in Camp Lejeune, Quantico. I deployed three times with 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines. And so, yeah, my Marine Corps career was pretty much on the East Coast.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for your service. And, you know, there's so much that's known and in the media about just how great a military force the Marines are and how important they are. What message would you have for, let's say, somebody who has either themselves or maybe a relative that's considering the Marine Corps? What would make that a drop-dead decision, yes, in your recommendation?
So first I would say, from coming from a military background, you know, my grandfather was in the Air Force, both my parents were in the Army. I have aunts and uncles in all different branches, but my brother Brian and I were the first to go into the Marine Corps. So first I would say, with that background, you know, if you're thinking about going to the military in general, pick the right branch for you, because every branch is different. Every branch has its own specialty, and they have a different mission and a role that they play. And I truly believe that, you know, everyone's character, your morals, values, ethics, and just the type of person you are, it has a unique fit not just for you in the world, but for the branch that you should pick, right? So not everyone's meant to be a Marine. That's okay, because we don't need, and the Marine Corps is the smallest branch. But first, pick the right branch for you that's going to fit, then pick, find the right job for you, and then just do it. It'll be a great experience. There's a lot of great benefits, not only educationally, but after your service, just from serving. So that would be it. It's definitely military service. You can't go wrong doing it, even if it's just for a quick 4 years. But make sure you pick the right branch, and then make sure you pick the right job for you.
Well, that's great advice. And thank you so much again for your service and all of these years. Now, I know that all Marines, and this is true, once a Marine, always a Marine, all Marines are looking to this coming Saturday, the anniversary. It's kind of hard to use that word, the anniversary of something so terrible, but it is the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. What would you think are the opinions or the thoughts as we look toward making this milestone anniversary for this date? What are you and thinking, and what would you think your other fellow Marines would have on their hearts and minds?
So given what happened recently with the withdrawal in Afghanistan, I think this anniversary is going to really mean a lot to a lot of service members just in general. I think some folks, there's a lot of mixed feelings. We all knew that we were going to have to leave at some point in time. I think just how it happened is the big issue. But overarchingly, I honestly feel hopeful for the veterans of this country, because after every war, our country does really, really well when the veterans come home. It happened after World War II. It happened after, the Civil War with the rebuilding of the country. And even after Vietnam in the 80s, after things kind of died down, we had the, Good Morning America. So we're coming out of the longest war in our country's history. The global war on terrorism, veterans, we seem to be a different breed. We really want to see value, and we really want to have an impact in the world and change things at a very macro level. So I think while it's somber and it's upsetting, I think it's going to put a lot of fuel in the gas tank and fire the fuel for a lot of veterans, whether it's in education, entrepreneurship, maybe even it's politically. We're going to see a spark of a lot of veterans getting involved and engaged, because we put skin in the game for this global war on terrorism. We're not really seeing the fruit of our labor, and so we want to see something happen, right? And I think you're going to see a lot of veterans taking advantage of the resources, opportunities that come from being a veteran and wanting to put forward a second form of service.
If you could go ahead and expand on that, you mentioned the recent debacle in Afghanistan, and the administration for President Biden is under great scrutiny, a lot of heat coming. You mentioned the way that withdrawal happened. And again, you're right, this was already kind of planned, but I don't think anyone in previous administrations would have ever foreseen that we could leave A, people behind, B, the amount of resources, including airplanes and helicopters behind, and then just leaving it in the way that we did. What thoughts do you have beyond what you've already expressed?
Well, the Taliban is now more empowered than they have ever been. With everything that was left behind, you hit a lot of wickets there. The resources, the military capabilities. I mean, for Pete's sake, even the military working dogs were left behind. I think that's why we're not seeing the Taliban right now being as brutal as they were before, because they have all this stuff now that they don't even know what to do with. But once they figure that out, I mean, Lord help us in this region, that region, because they are going to be have exponential capabilities that are beyond their wildest dreams, right? And so I think, that is one of the biggest heartbreaks for a lot of veterans, is these terrorists now have our weapons. They have our, we gave them exactly what we were trying to take away. And not only that, but we looked people in the eyes and we made promises and we worked with people who saved American lives that were just left behind. You know, it's just not what you do. No person with good morals, values, and ethics can look any service member in the eye and say, we left Afghanistan the right way. Absolutely not. You know, like we knew that we were going to have to withdraw. And I think if you talk to any service member who served in Afghanistan or Iraq, they would say the same thing. Like, yeah, you know, I foresaw this coming. Maybe not as quickly, but we definitely foresaw this coming. But we could have gotten our people out safely. We could have gotten out those who helped us safely if we had just done it the right way and thought about what we were doing. You know, Joe Biden said, the former president set a deadline of May 1, and blah, 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 and he inherited this problem and all this stuff. Well, hey, man, you didn't leave until August, right? So you had more months than what President Trump had initially planned on, and you totally just, gaffed it up, you know? And so there's really no excuse for the way that it was done. There's steps that should have been taken in terms of getting people out, evacuating, withdrawing in a systemic way with genuine concern and care for what you're doing, and not leaving not only Afghanis behind, but also American citizens. Like, bro, what are you thinking? You know, like any private who served in Afghanistan could have driven that much better, I think. And it just goes to show we put way too much money into the military-industrial complex. It shows that we put way too much money and faith into these politicians who have absolutely no idea what they're doing. And that's why I think veterans are going to stand up and say, you know what, you guys can't do it. Okay, let me go ahead and show you how to do it. Let me lead by example and utilize these resources out there, and we'll go ahead and get the job done. Now, it'll probably take 10 or 15, maybe even 20 years to get there, but I have complete faith in my brothers and sisters in arms, and I have complete faith and my fellow Americans that we're going to get this right.
Now, that is a big statement in light of the fact that the current president, the commander in chief, is there for another couple of years. What do you think is going to happen between now and the next election cycle with President Biden being skewered daily? I guess the second question was, do you believe that this will die down? I know the Marines and other branches always have said, never leave a man behind, never leave one behind. And yet we've left hundreds of Americans over there. What's going to happen with that? So those two questions.
Okay, so great question. I think two things. Biden's not getting reelected. That's safe to say, because he's really upset two large groups where he large voting blocks that he's just not going to be able to win back. That's one, military veterans and their families, and then also the Black community, because he said he was going to do a lot of stuff for African Americans that he just has not taken initiative on. So that's number one. Now getting to that, I do think people are going to forget about this, because, you know, when you think about what were we upset about before Afghanistan, it was inflation. You know, prices rising. What about before that? The country was upset about what, January 6th? Some people. What about before that? You know, now you forget. And that's only, January 6th was only, you know, months away. It hasn't even been a year. So if you think about 2 years or 3 years out towards the next election cycle, Afghanistan, people aren't going to be as mad about it. But what is going to be truly, I think, groundbreaking coming soon are going to be the campaign ads, because you're going to see all this stuff from Afghanistan come back, people falling from airplanes and, you know, the Marines who died and all this mess. These campaign ads are going to be brutal, and Biden's just not going to be able to escape that. I think he's probably going to do something really big about a year out. He's probably going to try and push decriminalization of marijuana, or maybe, I don't know. It'll be something really, really big to make people forget about, try to make people forget about the last 3 years, but the ads that are going to come out, I think he just won't be able to survive. So the real big question is going to be, who is the Republican Party going to put forward as the nominee? President Trump said he's going to jump in, but I truly think that we're going to see a lot more candidates probably out there this time. So who is the Conservative Party going to put forward as the next potential president? It's going to have to be a very diverse, dynamic, unique ticket. And there's a couple people who I think would be really good fits, but I don't know. There's a lot of runway between now and then. And, you know, 1 year in political time is like 4 or 5 lifetimes. So we'll see when we get there. But I think if we can just prevent the Biden administration from getting passing into legislation, a lot of things that would have give us a lot of heartburn in the future or ruin the country for 20, 30, 40 years down the road, we'll be ahead of the game.
I tell you, you've worked real hard as a member of this coalition that I mentioned, the Black Voices for Trump. And according to what I know about you, you raised the largest share of minority voters since 1960. Now, you've already mentioned that there's been a lot of promises that were made toward the Black community that have not been met. What do you see happening going forward?
Thank you for that. And it wasn't just me. A lot of credit needs to go to Sandra Benitez, Juan Mejia, Helder Toasty, and Alex Garcia and Kevin Cabrera down there in Florida. They blew the Latino vote like out of the water. People keep talking a lot about Blacks, but not enough attention is given to them about what they did with Latinos, especially in Florida. So hats off to them. That was really cool and unique to be able to do that. But I think in terms of, I think the second part of your question was the promises of the Biden administration, why he's going to have heartburn with minority voters. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, Democrats are only really good at branding and marketing. If you look at their policies and their politics that they implement across any major metropolitan area that's heavily Democratic, like they just do not perform well. And so this last election, it was really, you know, like a lot of Blacks looking at Democrats, Blacks and Latinos looking at Democrats and saying, all right, like we'll give you one more shot, but you got to put up or shut up. Otherwise, we're going to go in the other direction. And we've already seen through, you know, the Biden administration not connecting with Black Lives Matter immediately after, you know, he was elected, or really putting forward any legislation or, you know, signing any executive orders. So far in, you know, we haven't seen anything. We haven't heard that they're planning to do anything. And Kamala Harris has been MIA. Where's she at? You know, she's supposed to be the golden child. And she's nowhere. So I think a lot of Blacks are looking at this administration, not necessarily in terms of like, what have you done for me lately? But hey, we gave you the shot. We were expecting you to see you go heavy for us out the gate, like they did with Barack Obama. But he went heavy for the LGBT community. The Biden administration looks like they're going heavy, you know, towards the Asian community right now. And Blacks and Latinos just aren't going to stand for that. So I think you're going to see a huge party shift, a huge pendulum swing in the other direction. And that's why I go back to saying, you know, something really to watch is who are the candidates going to be in 2024? What are they going to promise or say that they're going to do? And how diverse are we going to see candidates in 2022 for these midterm elections? How many of them are going to win, right? And then from that, is the GOP at the macro high level going to truly invest in having more diversity, not just in the party, but particularly in party leadership and decision making? Are you giving these coalitions and these different groups money, you know, something tangible to put into to drive the coalition building and outreach efforts? So those are the couple of things. You know, candidates coming out, is money actually going into these communities? Are you actually seeing them put in serious leadership positions? And then are they being mobilized to counterbalance the marketing and the branding for the Democrat Party?
It is always wonderful to realize there are people like you, men of faith, men who believe in God, who are making a difference and standing up for what is right. Thank you, Harrison. We're going to be back in a moment. Don't go away. This is Afternoons with Mike. I am sitting here in the studio with Heather Case. Heather is the leader of One Purse, and that is an organization that we're going to hear all about. It's aimed at helping those coming out of the human trafficking condition, and it is a major problem in the world today. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate so much you having me on.
Well, I am so excited to hear how it is that you went from a career in finance and working in that industry to really helping people the way you're doing. And that's got to be a story in there.
Yes, it's been an adventure, that's for sure.
I bet it is. Heather, tell me a little bit about yourself. What part of the country did you grow up in?
Oh, I'm a native Floridian. I was actually born in St. Petersburg and moved to Brooksville, Florida when I was 7 years old and lived there till I graduated high school and then came over this way to go to college, UCF, and never left.
I always think of Brooksville as being that western end of Highway 50. Now, I don't know if that's the way, but I've been over there a couple of times. In fact, I've been in a nearby community to Brooksville, and that would be Homosassa Springs.
Yes, that's right. Home of the manatees.
Yes.
That's right.
Oh, I've done that attraction there many times.
Yes.
And that is the first place and the first time for that matter that I ever did see a manatee.
Yes, they're really beautiful up close there.
And it's also the place that when I had a boat, I almost flooded out and sunk my own boat in launching it at the marina there in Homosassa Springs. But that's for another story and another time.
Okay. That sounds like a good one.
We'll chalk that story up to what happens when you forget to put the drain plug in the back of the boat.
That might be the whole story
That might be the whole story. And it was almost the beginning of a really bad story. But by God's grace, we discovered in time, got the boat back out, and all was well.
That is good. That is good.
Now that I've publicly humiliated myself, we'll get on with your story. What was it like growing up in Brooksville?
Oh, wow. Well, my husband, who grew up here, would say I grew up in the sticks. I'm not sure that's a fair assessment of it, but it was a little bit more country life than Orlando is.
You had those gigantic oak trees with the moss hanging
yes,
from the trees.
That's right. Lots of cow pastures. Yeah, lots of pretty trees. It was good. It was a quiet town. My parents purposed to move us to Brooksville. We, originally being in St. Petersburg, they wanted to kind of move out of the city and into the country, and that we did.
And that would have been really, truly still old Florida feeling for that area. They really, I think, did a great job at just maintaining that kind of charm that was there probably 40 years earlier.
That is true. Getting a Walmart was a big deal in our town. Yeah, that's for sure.
Oh, my goodness. And were they believers, your folks?
Yes, my parents are both actually first generation believers. They met in Vietnam. My mom was a nurse and my dad was a flight medic. And
Americans meeting in Vietnam.
Yes, the Vietnam War brought them together. They had both come from hard places. And my mom actually came to Christ in Vietnam. Another nurse led her to Christ. And she didn't know at that time that to be unequally yoked was not the awesome choice. But God's grace is sufficient and has been sufficient for them. And shortly after I was born, my dad came to Christ as well. And
wonderful.
So I did grow up in a Christian home.
Oh, yeah. With both parents.
With both parents who are still married. And, today they just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary this summer.
Congratulations to them and to you. That is, I say that to you because it's a real privilege, I believe, to grow up with parents that have hung together and stayed together through, like you said, difficult times.
That's right. Absolutely a gift.
It is wonderful. They overcame all of that. And brothers, sisters, did you?
Yes, I have a sister and a brother. I'm the oldest. I have a sister who's 2 years younger than me. And then I have a brother who's 12 years younger than me.
So. What was your favorite thing doing when you were in Brooksville as a young person?
Oh, let's see. Well, we lived for a year at a Mennonite camp, and I reflect, that was actually our first year in Brooksville, and I reflect on that as being one of the best years of my childhood, just because.
You lived actually in the camp?
In the camp. That's right. We lived in the camp. It was a camp other churches would come to, and they had summer camps, and but as a young child, just having the run of a cool environment like that with campfires every night and, worship service and, skiing on the lake. I mean, it was just an awesome, time in my childhood.
Now, you weren't part of the culture of the Mennonites then?
No, the Mennonites owned the camp, and there were a number of Mennonites there mm-hmm. working in the camp. But my parents were not Mennonites. Mm-hmm. No, they yeah. were just employed there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's a very interesting lifestyle, a very interesting group, as are the Amish. And I didn't even realize there was a camp like that in Florida.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's called Lakewood Retreat. If you ever get a chance to go there, it's a beautiful camp.
That's wonderful. And having those experiences, it is fun being on a campground. I've not lived on one, but I certainly have been to one many times.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun.
It is. Great part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how was it that you came to a personal knowledge and relationship with Jesus?
Yeah. So I actually, when I was very young, 4 years old, my mom would do devotional time with me. And at 4 years old, I gave my life to Christ. I still remember that moment. I did have a pretty significant prodigal run in my teens into my early 20s. So I would say that I recommitted my life to the Lord in 2000 and began walking with him more closely. But I really do look back at that time as a four-year-old of being my salvation experience, and that the Spirit was with me through all of those years and just wooing me back, I would say.
Well, that's wonderful. You know, so many times when I'm talking like with you and I have a guest in here, that is their shared experience. Mm-hmm. And you're starting off strong for the Lord, really significant. And yet there seems to be for so many of us a prodigal season where we just walk away. Mm-hmm. Seemingly we've left the faith, but so often we find out that is not. If we left the faith did not leave us.
Amen.
And the Lord just drew you back to him.
He did. He did.
So now, faithful. At some point, you started going to school with an interest in obvious things, all things ministry and all things theology. How did that happen?
Yeah, so that's more recent in my life. In 2017, I came to be aware of an all-female cohort that was starting up at Wheaton College, actually started by Christine Kane and her organization Propel. It was all-female. We're actually the first all-female cohort in Wheaton history. So I started my graduate studies in evangelism and leadership, and I'm in my final week of class, actually, this week. And I'll be taking some comp exams in November, and I will be done. Praise God.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite an adventure for sure.
Yeah.
How many years have you been working at that?
4 years.
Four years.
Yes.
And that's great.
Yeah. It's been awesome. I mean, really, I feel like it's been another season of transformation in my faith. I really feel like, we only know what we know growing up in our streams of the church. And when you come into places where you see other streams coming together, we can learn so much from one another. Mm-hmm. And I've really had a beautiful experience there.
Now, that's ministry oriented, obviously. And you've also done the whole business thing.
Yeah.
So you worked for a number of years in finance.
I did. That's right. Actually started working while I was finishing college, just started out as a cashier in the finance industry and worked my way up through that industry. And when I left in 2009, I was the vice president of servicing for the Southeast. So I had gained a lot of responsibility, a lot of employees. It was a good experience, but it was also very laborious. And I had 4 children by then. Actually, when I left in 2009, I had twins that were only a year old and 2 other children. So life at home was really full. Yes, yes. They were beckoning me to give them more of myself. And so that was really my exit point. Yeah.
Now, how did this happen where you gained, let's say, a burden for human trafficking?
I would say the seeds of that in my life would go back to that prodigal season. There were some hard things that I walked through. I was never trafficked, and I'm very clear about that. But I did get involved in a relationship that was very violent. So I experienced some domestic violence there in my later teen years, early 20s. And I really feel like that's what the Lord has allowed that tendered my heart toward the survivors that we serve today. It's just my own experience. And the fact that he saved me, and that he redeemed, my story, my life. And I believe that's possible for those that we serve today. And that really is the heart of why I do it.
Now, there's a lot of people that still really have a hard time getting their brain around some of the terms that would be attributed to trafficking. In addition to trafficking would be like sex slaves.
Yes.
And so when they hear that, I think a lot of people, it is so foreign, it's so offensive, it's so out there to a lot of people's lives, they do have a hard time believing that this is as close and present to us in Central Florida as what it really is.
And it really is. And that would be my story too. When I started One Purse back in 2011, if you had asked me what trafficking was, I would have described something in the developing world. I honestly had no idea that it was happening here, what it looked like here, or, you know, how people in our community were affected by it. But what you come to understand is that it's like anything where there's an opportunity for money to be made and humans to be exploited, you know, evil, you know, takes root. And so, you know, in our culture, it looks like oftentimes, and, you know, this is something that I like to take off an opportunity to clarify, people sometimes have a vision of, you know, white vans and abductions and things like that. That is a very small percentage of human trafficking.
It does happen,
victims.
But it is a smaller percentage.
It does happen, but it is a very small percentage. The majority of trafficking victims in our culture are individuals that may have been on the margin for one reason or another to begin with. Either due to poverty, neglect, you know, family dysfunction, addiction.
Now, when you say on the margin of what specifically?
I would say on the margin of life, you know, like, you know, those who are, you know, not necessarily living in homes where there's a lot of care, provision, opportunity, and where there's emotional neglect, you know, relational neglect. And so therefore, when traffickers, you know, come in contact with those individuals, they're able to see those vulnerabilities and to exploit those vulnerabilities. Oftentimes, and this is another commonality, through relationships initially that look to mm-hmm. the recipient as something positive or mm-hmm. something good or something genuine, when in fact there's very strong ulterior motives. Very hidden for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Traffickers are very masterful. They will spend 6 months, 12 months, 18 months in some cases, you know, building relationship before, you know, before they exploit that individual. Mm-hmm. But all the way along, breaking down slowly, one little increment at a time, boundaries. And, you know, and things that make that individual, ultimately, we look at what the outcome is and we say, how could they have made that choice, or how could they have been so foolish, or how could they have believed? But what we don't see is all the little pieces all along the way where they were being groomed, where they were being, you know, really trained into or brought into trafficking.
At the root of all this in Florida, would you think there's a syndicate that really, let's say, a mastermind plan or an organization from which most of the trafficking happens? Or is it just like a one-off thing where groups of people are doing the same thing but not related necessarily to one another?
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for traffickers to have multiple victims, but I would not see it as organized a crime as you mm-hmm. might consider other crimes to be. You know, there, it's very territorial, but it's also not uncommon for a trafficker to sell, you know, one of their victims to another trafficker for one reason or another. So they do move among, you know, there is sort of a network, I would say, in some cases, but not necessarily organized and orchestrated in that way.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It's so sad to hear it, but what you've described is what I've heard a lot, where a young lady, and it's not just the ladies, there are young men who are trafficked as well. And they meet someone that they find attractive. That person gives them all the feels, all of the senses of being loved and maybe appreciated. And like you said, oftentimes these are kids that maybe have been on the outs, mm-hmm. societally speaking. Maybe they're uncomfortable in crowds, but all of a sudden they're made to feel like they're special. Mm-hmm. They're made to feel like they're desired and wanted by what seems to be a good relationship.
Yes.
And they give in to that.
That's right.
And they don't even necessarily know for a long time, like you said, mm-hmm. that where this is going.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Similar to how if you have an understanding of gangs and the ways in which, you know, especially children or, you know, are brought into gangs, it's a lot of times because there's not a belonging in their life. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't sense they belong someplace. And so, you know, a bad place to belong is better than no place to belong in their minds. And then oftentimes they don't see it as a bad place until they're already, you know, in over their heads in it. So,
and yeah. a lot's already happened, a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak. And these kids often feel like there's no out.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where, I mean, what that I would say would be one of the intersection points that I can, you know, relate to that part of why don't you leave? Why, you know, why do you stay if this is what you're experiencing? But, you know, fear and, you know, the threats and the not knowing what would be on the other side of the leaving. There's a lot of complex reasons. And there's true trauma bonds. I mean, they're even though this person, you know, has perpetrated these things and required these things of them, it's not uncommon for them to have very strong emotions toward this person, even though they have harmed them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
almost like a dysfunctional or an codependent type of relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, that is sad. And you're right. There is a strong correlation between an abusive husband and a wife that is being battered to some of these situations. And because these people look at those individuals that brought them into it, and even though they should really be bitter and angry, and they're oftentimes still desiring to have their approval.
That's right.
And it
That's
is, right. it's a tough thing to deal with. And it's really hard, again, for people who are not touched at all by it. It's a difficult thing to get our brain around.
Yeah.
That it is as big and reaching far into our culture yeah. is what it does.
Yeah, absolutely. And Florida, you know, significantly so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have one of the highest rates of trafficking in the country, at least reported cases, you know, which you can look at that more than one way. I mean, it means we're doing a better job of getting the word out and, you know, encouraging people to report. If they see something, say something. But we also believe that that correlates to the volume of it that's happening in our state. And statistics are hard things because, you know, this is something that happens in darkness.
It does. My guest today is Heather Case. She's with One Purse. She is the founder and CEO. We'll hear more about that organization and we'll chat more with Heather when we get back. This is Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. Back again here with Heather Case, and she's the founder and CEO of One Purse. Now, I know this organization is all about what we were talking about in segment one. It's an organization aimed at helping those and assisting those coming out of sex trafficking, human trafficking. How did the name One Purse happen?
Okay, so I was in that finance industry, right? Came home to be with my children, was not looking for something else to do, but I was shopping in an upscale consignment store and I found a purse that I fell in love with. But now I was a stay-at-home mom, really was not in the budget any longer. But, and your female audience may understand this, I left the purse, but it did not leave me. I went back and visited this purse several times.
I've done that with guitars. So I get it.
Okay, yeah. Good. I feel better. and on one of those last visits, the Lord just prompted my heart that for the amount of money I was considering spending on that one purse, that I could change someone else's life.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I'd never had an experience like that before, certainly not around purses. I had carried nice bags and have carried nice bags since. But for whatever reason, that day, he used that object to grab my heart. And at the inception of One Purse, all I knew is that we were to be in service to vulnerable women and children. I didn't even know that I would ultimately end up working in this anti-trafficking space. It's really just been a journey with the Lord of, you know, just following where he led. And even that first incident with the purse, like, okay, Lord, you're speaking to me through this purse, but what is it that you want me to do?
Mm-hmm.
He was really faithful in that. I was reading a book at that time called The Hole in Our Gospel. And there were two quotes in there that really stuck out to me. One was by the founder of World Vision at the time. He said, "Don't fail to do something because you can't do everything," which I think is where a lot of us get stuck.
Well said. Yeah.
And then Mother Teresa, she said, "We can do no great things, only small things with great love." And those two quotes really encouraged me that the Lord was calling me, even if it felt small, to do something with purses to help vulnerable women and children. So as it kind of came together, I invited my girls in my Bible study to donate their gently loved handbags and come to my house on a Saturday morning and just pick out a handbag that was new to them, and that we would give those proceeds to help. At that time, we funded a freshwater well project. Like I said, I only knew vulnerable women and children. And but within that first year, we started helping trafficking survivors through another project here locally. And the more I came to understand that issue, the more that I came to understand their need, it was the one that wouldn't let me go. And so by 2014, we had converted to exclusively serving survivors. And, you know, that's what we do today.
So how do you find these survivors, or do they find you?
Yeah, so it's through partners. And this would probably be a good place to say, really, there's a continuum of care to survivors. A lot of times the things we see on the news is all about kind of the identification phase. You know, there might be a sting or something where they're brought out. But then they usually need to move through some form of stabilization, especially if there's been drugs involved, you know, detoxing. Oftentimes then we'll move into maybe a restoration phase where they're maybe in a safe home or working with a drop-in center or a program like that. And then we work at the transition to thrive kind of place on that continuum of care. So all of the survivors that we serve are referred to us by partners, our partner network. So they've been served at those earlier stages of the continuum of care and are referred to us for scholarships. You know, that's, we provide them with scholarships and next step resources. And in October of last year, we actually launched a work therapy program. So we now have a survivor that we're employing, and I was doing some interviews today. We're going to be hiring a second one this month. So
when you say scholarships to schooling or some other type of scholarship?
Yeah, educational or vocational, whatever their next right step or need is to move themselves forward for economic stability. Sometimes that looks like locally, this is really awesome, Valencia College will provide the tuition coverage for a survivor, but they may still need a computer, or they may need some ancillary, you know, needs to be able to move forward in their education. And so we help them with that. Sometimes it's vocational training. You know, we've had survivors that have gone and gotten their real estate license, or, you know, learned how to do hair, you know, whatever it is that they desire to do, we come alongside of them with resources. In that.
Now, you mentioned having a bunch of friends that you kind of all pool together this one ability. How does one purse work now with getting helpers, getting volunteers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So COVID actually kind of did a number on our model.
Oh, they did a number on everything.
But by God's grace, and this is how he works, right? It was really turned out to be a very beautiful thing in our model. So prior to COVID, it was all those gatherings when we would come together in churches. COVID hit, we took a lot of bags that we had on hand and started selling them in the e-commerce space, and had so much success that was really the catalyst for starting the e-commerce program and being able to employ. That was our long-term strategy, but the Lord just fast-forwarded that for us. And so the survivor that's working with us now, her full-time job is to come in and list those bags for sale on e-commerce. And those bags are donated to us by women in the community. We're actually beginning to get bags shipped to us from women around the country. So it's exciting.
It's so ironic that this thing that was used by the Lord to get your heart has now been something that's kind of an intricate part, integral part in everything you're doing.
Absolutely. That's right. And so we right now have a 1,000 bag challenge going on. We're trying to get people in the community. We're nearing 800 bags that have been donated to us. And we're trying to get to that 1,000 bag mark, because that really represents, you know, in the sell through, what it will cost us to employ that survivor for a year. So for every 1,000 bags we can get donated to the organization, that translates into employment for a survivor for a year.
Now, as a husband of a wife that loves bags, I have learned from just doing accompanying shopping with her there are plenty of places that sell very expensive bags.
Yes, there are. And we would say gently loved designer purses. And when someone says, what does that mean? It means it needs to have a brand name. That brand name does not have to be Louis Vuitton. That brand name can be Coach or Kate Spade or Michael Kors, you know. But
amazing is I know all three of the names.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's
good
just
husband.
Crazy
you're a
that
good
I
husband.
Know that. Yeah.
But, you know, so in other words, they have to have a resale value because that is what we're doing with them. And so, you know, but really anything in that spectrum, we have a lot of success with converting those to the resources needed.
So when these people are coming in and you are now scholarshiping a person to the next level, maybe it's helping them buy a computer, like you said, for studies at one of the colleges. Do you get to stay in touch with that person?
Yes, we do. We encourage them along their journey. We have a number of survivors that we've given multiple year scholarships to who are now in their second, third year of college. And we have a place on our website. This is actually a new way that we're loving on them for prayer. So they can go in and make a request for any prayer needs that they have, put it on this prayer wall on our website, and then we pray over it. They actually get an email letting them know when we're praying for them. We send them birthday cards. We do a local stocking drive at Christmas time, and in collaboration with some of our partners, we distribute over 100 Christmas stockings. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we find other ways throughout the year to love on them. But you know, our primary role in their progress is just making sure that they're making that next step, you know, that they have the resources they need.
From your experience, Heather, what is the point that you could say, maybe from what you've seen, where a girl that's come up out of this, in particular thinking of a young lady that's come out of this lifestyle, how does she and how would others around her know when she's actually made it, when she's actually come all the way out?
I would be in the camp that would say it's somewhat of a lifelong journey. And I say that because you know, survivors of trafficking have experienced PTSD at rates comparable to war veterans. You know, their trauma, you know, the journey of overcoming what they've come through. And that's not to say that we don't see some that really hit their stride, you know, 3 and 4 years in. Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. But I think one thing that's, you know, we exist so that re-exploitation does not happen. What we see in this, there's a statistic that says as many as 80% of survivors who come out of trafficking are at risk of being re-exploited again.
Yeah, that's a high number
right there.
Yeah.
It is heartbreaking. But if you take that back to the conversation about who's at risk, right? Mm-hmm. They're on the margin to begin with, right? For one reason or another. They're helped out and these resources are brought around them early on, right? But if we don't acknowledge that those circumstances in their life don't magically disappear just because there was an intervention, just because they broke out of that situation. And so we really believe in collaboration. That's why we're really big on our partners. We believe in creating kind of a chorus around them of people who are really believing in them and for them, for the lives that they're trying to, you know, really reclaim. So,
well, it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. And I cannot imagine the horror that there must be in a life of a young person who maybe at age 14, 15 have actually still been trafficked for 3 or 4 years or longer. Some of them very early, started off, and it's got to be one of the darkest sides of American life. It's everywhere. It's happening in just about every state. Mm-hmm. And sadly, in cities that seem like wholesome, family-oriented cities, like I believe Orlando would once have been thought to be, and I've heard of some in our Shepherd audiences, all of the cities where we have Shepherd stations have been known to have trafficking going on in a big way.
Yeah, it's everywhere, and I would say as the church, you know, the conversation we need to continue to have is, what's driving that, right? Because it's a supply and demand issue. And, you know, obviously helping survivors is important, but we really do have to really take a look at what the root issue is and why it's happening in our culture. And what can we do as believers to war against it, that human beings that made in the image of God would, that we would find it acceptable in our presence in any way that they be bought and sold for sex.
Yeah, it's just unthinkable to me. And so the number one thing that all of us should and can do is pray, that we can pray for all of these people. And then number two, I think getting involved in some degree, even if it's giving something to an organization like One Purse to help someone. I know there's organizations like Letitia's House in Orlando and other places like that, Created in Gainesville. These are people that are they're just doing oftentimes a front lines work where they've actually got a home where these people are coming straight out of trafficking into the home.
That's right.
And that is a critical part as well. But there's a need, and it sounds like you've got an ability, and people can join hands with you and see them through several steps down as they are reintegrating back into culture.
Absolutely. They can join us in prayer by going to that prayer wall that I mentioned on our website, you know, onepurse.org, the pray button there. They can be part of praying over some of those needs. They can absolutely collecting bags from, in their community, at their business, at their church. You know, that's huge for our work. That is the fuel that is making it possible for us to employ survivors and to provide these resources to them. And then, you know, always giving. Giving is always good.
You know, I think back, One Purse changed your life. Mm-hmm. One purse that your heart wanted, that you desired. And out of that comes a calling, and out of that comes a ministry that is now helping who knows how many kids. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful thing. Yeah. Heather Case, thank you. Give us that website one more time.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. It's www.onepurse.org.
Heather Case, founder of onepurse.org, and we can certainly join and pray we must, because this is a big problem. Many thanks to Heather and also Harrison from earlier on. We'll see you next time on Afternoons with Mike.